Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Order Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 3:09 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is September 1st. Today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. So I think there's a couple of things that really do need to be covered this week. The first is oil prices are breaking higher, and that has broken the medium-term downtrend. So I think on a nominal basis, it's important. On an inflation-adjusted basis, it's also important. And then, of course, when we think about the trajectory of inflation, then that's also going to be important. Then I think we can also look at what's happening in government bond yields. And it's an awfully big question. Is this a new inflationary trend that's going to persist for several years, or are we going to have a deflationary trend immediately afterwards? And of course, that is going to very much depend on whether there is a soft landing, a hard landing, and more importantly, whether the trend of government deficits in the USA are ever going to bottom out. Then let's also talk about what's going on in China. And there's obviously a lot of difficulty there. They have increased total debt in the country from 17 to 53 trillion in the last decade. So that is basically all happened under Xi Jinping's watch. And what they've basically done is substitute deteriorating growth from spending on infrastructure for debt. And they've been funding any growth since then with debt. And eventually that is going to become a problem, because you get diminishing returns the more debt you add on, and therefore it requires even more debt to be sustained. And at some point you reach the point, well, where you just can't do it anymore. And I think that's a big question. And of course, it's an awfully big question for China. It's a big question for commodity exporters. And then it's an even bigger question for the smaller countries in Asia in particular that compete with China. So those are important questions. Then I think we should think about the trend of technological innovation. I think there's an important point to be made about the overall trend of technological innovation as we go from conceptual stage through universities into startups, then through that process into commercialization. And then comparing that to the timing of monetary accommodation. It's a lot easier to start a company, get it listed, and accumulate resources to push the technology forward when interest rates are low and money is available. It's a lot more difficult to get that done when money is less available. And that, of course, is also going to play into exactly what's going to happen in terms of the interest rate cycle. There are incredibly positive things happening in the technology sector, and they do have the real potential to enhance the standard of living for billions of people. But then the question, of course, is not so much about whether the promise of technology will eventually be fulfilled, because it very likely will, but rather how do we make money from it, and whether it will be easy or difficult in order to do that. And then I think we should just spend some time to think about where are we in the broader cycle. So let's kick off, and we'll start to look at the Brent crude price. What subscribers will also, I think, before I get into that, see is that I'm going to be posting the audio as part of the commentary, but I'll also post it independently as a podcast. And that podcast will be accompanied by a transcript. And in due course, I'll start editing those transcripts and make them look a bit more pretty, or dolly them up a bit. But for the moment, I'm just going to post them as a raw transcript. And I've done an experiment with it today, and I was reasonably happy with the results of that. We're in the transition period right now from moving from the website into Substack. And that is going to come with a couple of bumps along the way. At least our website is running again today, and the chart library is up and running. And I'll post Duly. I'll post everything on the website and in Substack for at least the next week until we've ironed out the wrinkles. But then ultimately we will simply be posting everything on Substack, and subscribers will still have the chart library available via the website. So oil prices were up nearly $2 today, and this is a new recovery high. It's now pushing up out of this little first step above the type 2 bottom. So we have now got what's developing into a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. It has clearly broken the downtrend, and we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside until we see a very clear countermanding downward dynamic. Now, I've also got the chart for oil adjusted for CPI, and this is a long-term chart. We can see that the peak that we had back in 2022 equated the peak from 1980 on a CPI adjusted basis. Obviously, the massive move higher that we had in 2008 was a very different phenomenon overall. So let's just compare where we are right now in terms of those prices from back in 2008. And we can therefore clearly see that on a nominal price appreciation, that yes, prices were higher then, and it was a new all-time high, but we're still at reasonably elevated levels on a nominal basis. And overall, this has been a very long range. And I think this is one of the more important points, that we do get these long ranges in commodity prices. And what we're looking at right now is a range that is mostly between about $40 and $140. And moves outside of that band have generally corresponded with very swift moves back inside the band. So now prices are steadying from the $75 area, and it does look likely that they're going to move higher from here. And that is going to come with inflationary repercussions. So as energy prices rise, the cost of production of just about everything else is going to go up with it. And that is something that is going to start filtering down into some of those inflationary figures over the course of the next quarter and subsequent quarters. What we saw in economic statistics this week was that inflation didn't come down, but it didn't go up a lot either. That employment has risen, but not as fast as before, and that wages, or these wage growth, is moderating. So that was viewed as potentially something that could result in the Federal Reserve pausing the pace of interest rate hikes. But this move in oil prices is something that will make them sit up and pay attention, because it clearly holds out the potential that we're going to see inflationary pressures moving on the upside. So let's look at a few of those energy companies. ExxonMobil, which has been ranging now for most of the last year, continues to firm within its range. But I think more important than that is it had broken above the $100 level and has been consolidating there for the last 9 months. And this is really quite impressive action. So this looks like a first step above the base. And we're going to have to see a really significant decline in oil prices to bring that price back down below the 100 level. Then let's think about the kind of business model that some of these oil companies have had to deal with. So Shell is now coming back up towards the 2500p level, and that's the upper side of what's an exceptionally lengthy range. And the share has been subject to incredible volatility over the course of the last 20 years. But one thing that's clear is they are now walking back on their commitment to carbon emissions reduction. Shell spent a ton of money on trying to mitigate some of their carbon emission output. And what they found was that you can either have volume or you can have quality, but you can't have both. And because of the, I guess, the position that they're in as a lightning rod for protests, then they can't afford to get it wrong. So they invested a ton of money in trying to build or trying to grow mangrove swamps, trying to plant trees in the highlands of Scotland. But the reality is that these things don't grow quickly. And they make the decision that they can't go off and introduce new species because they would grow faster, because that's the exact or the perfect example of doing it fast rather than doing it well. And they've basically concluded that to actually decarbonize, not just talk about it, not just put some money into something that says it's going to do it without actually doing it, but actually decarbonizing is a very difficult thing to do and exceptionally expensive. And it's just not something that they feel that they're going to be able to actually deliver on. So they've stopped talking about it. Doesn't mean that they're going to stop spending money on it, and there will be some carbon mitigation issues. But then the other point, of course, is that they are an energy company and energy prices are rising. And as energy prices rise, well, then profits improve, and then they have a natural incentive to increase supply. And of course, where is that supply going to come from? Well, I think it's quite clear. One of the untapped areas over the last decade has been offshore, and one of the marketing exercises that major oil companies have been going through is to basically say that carbon emissions from offshore are lower than those from onshore. Now, that says nothing about the risk of oil spills or of the difficulty of getting them out there or drilling the wells, but they are less carbon emissions. And the oil services sector is still trading at a fraction of where it was after the significant crash between about 2014 and 2020. And of course, that crash was driven by shale oil. When there's a lot of unconventional oil, you don't have to have a lot of infrastructure sitting offshore. You don't have to have the ships. You don't have to have lots of engineers. You can have lots of people putting in pads in West Texas and easily driving between the two. And that was a phenomenally large bear market for the oil services sector. And at the same time, there hasn't been nearly as much money going into supporting supply growth because the energy sector has been under such incredible duress from a political or environmental perspective. But inflationary pressures tend to have a significant knock-on effect. Now, when we think about the lag between regulation and action in terms of prices, well, what's happening in the UK is a very good example of that, where the low emissions zone has been extended into the suburbs of London. And this is going to introduce additional costs for consumers in a part of the city where people are much more car dependent, and in an environment where prices for oil are rising and where European natural gas prices have stabilized at levels that are well above where they were ahead of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So I think this is something where we're going to have to see a great deal of regulatory change, where governments are going to have to start coming around to the idea that delivering energy isn't just about the supply, it's about cost and about reliability, and then subsequently also about emissions. Obviously, everybody wants to live somewhere with clean air, but if people can't afford to live, then obviously that's going to have electoral repercussions. And European natural gas prices are still stabilizing above where they had peaked all the way before the peak, or I guess the big run-up in 2021. So It does look like energy prices are moving on the upside. But then I think it's also particularly interesting what's happening in Saudi Arabia right now, because they are to talk about selling an additional $50 billion dollars worth of Saudi Aramco shares. And Aramco stock is starting to move on the upside here, despite the risk of additional supply coming into the market. So when we think about then, well, what do they want with that 50 billion? I think the answer is quite clear. And anyone who's visited Saudi Arabia over the last couple of years, it's very clear. Something I saw, and particularly from talking to lots of young people, that their enthusiasm around the development of the domestic economy and the need to move away from oil production and to create business and opportunity, and the message that the Crown Prince is delivering is, rather than go abroad, why don't we bring it here? And the most obvious, I guess, example of that is sports clubs, where Saudi Arabia is buying up sports clubs and moving them to Saudi Arabia. But what they're also doing then is developing the domestic economy and attempting then to wean dependence away from fossil fuels. And they're developing the mining sector. They're going to start building lithium refineries. They have in country lithium resources. Saudi Arabia owns a big chunk of Lucid. And Lucid Group probably is going to need the assistance of a big brother in order to support its survival. The share is now back in the region of the lows from earlier this year. I don't think it's going to go bust because I think it will eventually just get bought out by Saudi Arabia. I'm seeing an increasingly large number of Rivians on the road on the school run. And of course, Amazon owns a big chunk of that. So Rivian is putting in a first step above the base. Then contrast some of this performance, and of course the performance that we've seen recently in Tesla as well, where the share has clearly bounced from the region of the 200-day moving average, but it was certainly in negative territory in here this week. And compare that to Ford, where they have this impending, very difficult negotiation with their unions, and the share is right back in the region of the lows and wasn't able to hold the breakout from last June in response to that threat of having to pay a ton of money in terms of rising wages. And that wage negotiation issue is something that is going to factor into inflationary pressures as well. And General Motors is the same, right back in the region of its lows from the last year. It's a very well-defined range, and we're not going to have a clear signal until the range has been completed. But these legacy companies have to spend a ton of money in order to not only continue to build the trucks that they sell, but also then to build out their electric vehicle suite as well. One thing that I think is also rather interesting is that Toyota is breaking on the upside, and they have redefined their business model. They're now starting to hold a lot more inventory, and I think this is a very different environment than we had before the pandemic. Not only are they building fewer cars, but that they're holding more inventory, and not just as cars, but as parts. So, Japan, having basically created the just-in-time business model, is now starting to walk away from it. And Toyota, in particular, is being rewarded for that. And they also have this hybrid vehicle market pretty much tied up. And that's also something that has encouraged investors. So Toyota is clearly breaking on the upside here. And it's been trending higher now for a decade. And This has been the clear standout from the Japanese market overall. But Japan's market is doing better. And the devaluation of the currency is certainly a factor in promoting growth. The TOPIX index broke out to a new high in here today. And you really have to look at a lot of back history to really just comprehend how lengthy the bear market was and how close we are now to the all-time peaks. But I think it's also worth just looking at this on a nominal currency basis and a currency-adjusted basis. So, from the perspective of a US dollar investor, the index is bouncing from both the region of the 200-day and the 1,000-day moving average. And it had broken out in 2020, but didn't quite hold all of it. And it is now firming from the region of the upper side of the 1990 through to 2018 range. And I think if this trend continues, then it's not particularly ambitious to think that we're going to see prices breaking on the upside here. So we could see new all-time highs for the Japanese market. And that is also as part of a more aggressive pace of reindustrialization and a very clear understanding within Japan that they need to get more aggressive in terms of their international competition and also the need to become a compelling or at least a convincing deterrent to China's emergence in East Asia. But the Japanese market is certainly being supported by the currency, and the currency was in negative territory again in here today. The dollar was quite firm today. So now let's go and look at those 10-year treasury yields, because we had an upside key day reversal in here today. Very clear confirmation of support for the yield around the 4% level. And this has been an orderly consolidation over the course of the last year. So what I'm looking at doing now is hedging my long in TLT with a long in the Treasury future, because I think that there's the potential here that we might see TLT drop down through the 90 level. So I'm going to start hedging my exposure there, because I think that there is the potential that with oil prices moving higher, and then also with deficits still running at historic levels, that eventually we're going to see inflationary pressures ramping higher. Now, I don't believe that the threat of a recession has been avoided just yet. I do find that the personal savings chart is very interesting, because it did pull back exceptionally violently during the credit crisis, but then it really trended higher for most of the decade, and then it exploded on the upside in 2020, and that was a great example of people having lots of money and nowhere to spend it. But it didn't take long for people to figure out that they could spend it, and then savings started to come back down. And then savings kept coming down, and now they're starting to come back down again. So we're in an environment where people are now very eager to live their best lives, and they're not saving for the future. They're not really thinking about the possibility that their earnings or their spending power is going to be impeded at any point in the future. And Certainly not worried about risk. And why would they be? Because when we had the pandemic, then governments literally threw money into the pockets of consumers and told them to go out and spend it. And that's exactly what they did. And I think most people now are of the opinion that whenever there is an economic problem in the future, that's exactly what they can expect. That we will again see stimulus checks. And if that is the case, well, then why would anyone stop spending? So they're not going to stop spending until they run out of money. And even then, they're going to continue spending because we continue to see that the demand for credit continues to rise. But then there are additional moderating factors that are going to start popping up in the third quarter, or I guess the fourth quarter of this year. So the student loan borrowers are going to start having to pay back their loans in October. This personal savings chart is still trending downwards. The affordability of homes is at really record highs. This is something that is also eventually going to factor into demand. And this is an inverse chart. So the lower it goes, the less affordable housing is. So we have to then zoom out and look at a lot of history to get to a level where we have these kinds of lows. So properties relative to wages are still exceptionally high, but there's no new supply. So this is something that's going to continue to contribute to a tight environment. Now, if you have inflation and slower economic growth overall, well, that's stagflation. And that's the kind of environment where the Federal Reserve isn't going to be in a position to cut interest rates. So that, I think, is why the 10-year yield is moving higher. Now, let's also look at it in terms of the total return. So, this was the most consistent trend in the world for about 40 years. And now it has been broken and it is trending downwards. Now, when something that has been going up for 40 years starts going down, well, then I think we do have to sit up and start paying attention. The reason that I was long of the 10-year, or I guess long of TLT, was simply because I thought that deflationary forces were inevitable and that that would help to support bonds. I still think that deflationary forces will be inevitable, but that we might have a lengthier period of time before they actually arrive because oil prices are starting to back up again. Eventually, we'll see a reversion to the mean. And I think it's at that point then that we'll get another very attractive shorting opportunity for the bond market. Now, I did say earlier I wanted to buy futures, and I think that isn't the correct thing. What I've done today is I've shorted the future because that's a very clear downside Q reversal. And it's also pulling back from the most recent of the lower valley highs. We had a similar sized downward dynamic at the beginning of August. And we have quite a number of key reversals on the chart. But the sequence of lower valley highs is still very much intact. Now, the bigger question, of course, is the sustainability of debt. And this is obviously an issue. Because when governments are spending more than they've got, they have to go into the market and borrow it. And that is going to siphon liquidity out of the banking sector. And that's the primary reason why the regional banks were underperforming in March and then subsequently have encountered resistance in the region of the 1,000 and 200-day moving averages. But the index was in positive territory in here today. And several of those regional banks are heavy weightings within the Russell 2000. And the Russell 2000 has also been firming from the region of the 200-day and 1,000-day moving average. So investors are, on the one hand, looking at the valuation discount that you have in the small caps and thinking that that might justify a long position. Whereas when we look at the NASDAQ 100, prices have moderated somewhat and we're in mildly negative territory in here today, but that doesn't look like anything other than a short-term consolidation. So investors are no longer willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the possibility that there will be a recession and the preeminence of the US market relative to everyone else, everywhere else, remains undaunted. And as long as the mega cap companies continue to trend higher relative to the entire NYSE, it would be hard to argue that we aren't still in a benign economic environment for these very large companies. And of course, they have large piles of cash on which they can depend. Apple, for example, has, and I do apologize, I haven't typed in the ticker correctly. But it has 166 billion in cash, and then most of these very large companies have a very large stockpile of cash. Google with 120 billion, and then Microsoft, Amazon are all sitting on significant cash, well in excess of 100 billion. So they have the potential to weather the storm in terms of rising interest rates. In fact, they've got the corporate treasury to have been able to source cheap funding when the yields were low, and now their cost, their weighted average cost of capital has improved considerably. So they're still exhibiting a great deal of relative strength. Now, the one thing that I've seen more of than anything else is an argument that we have value that is trading at historically low levels relative to growth. And that's true. And that underperformance is still intact. Now, we also have the massive underperformance of commodities relative to growth. And that's also true. Commodity prices on a relative basis compared to the exceptional outperformance of technology, they're at an epic low. And then we also have the underperformance of the US relative to the US. And that's also at a very low historic level. So the long-term prediction is that this exceptionally low valuation of value, everything that's ex-US and commodities will eventually reverse, and that we'll have a new secular bull market in all three of those assets. But that is a big ask. So let's just examine the four different asset classes and address them individually, and then think about where are the secular bull market potentials in all four of these assets. So on the one hand, we have commodities, and let's look at the CRB index. We used to look at the CCI index, but then Refinitiv has made it a private index. So the CRB is very heavily weighted by oil, and it has rebounded. We've had a very impressive rebound over the last 2.5 years by oil prices, and they're firming again. And it's within the context of this much wider process of ranging over the course of the last 10 years. To have a commodity bull market, you need supply and elasticity meets rising demand. So, on the one hand, we can listen to the miners and to the oil producers, and what they're basically saying is that there hasn't been any money flowing into the sector for the last decade. And the difficulty of building new mines or drilling new holes is even more difficult now than it has been in the past because of environmental regulations, because of higher taxes, because of nationalism in various governments around the world, and then because of the volatility in the metal prices themselves, then there just hasn't been the same volume of money spent on developing new mines. So there's your supply inelasticity argument. And then they have the rising demand question. And the rising demand question is universally centered on the enthusiasm for building out the renewable energy infrastructure. But the one problem that we have, or at least that I have with that, is that if we look at some of these companies, the really big ones, like Vestas Wind Systems, that is the world leader in building wind turbines. Well, you might argue that it's building support above the $20 level. And I mean, remember now to just put this into local currencies. So we might argue that it's building support, but it would be difficult to argue that this is a new big uptrend. And instead, there's the potential that it is just building support around the 150 crown level, and that we could be in for prolonged ranging. And then, of course, we had the really significant decline this week in Ørsted, and they're complaining that they've had difficulties in putting in power, difficulties in their cost of production, the quality of their components, and their cost overruns are contributing to a significant downtrend, and the share collapsed in trading this week. But it's a medium-term downtrend. It's been going down for 3 years. Now, we might argue, yes, there is the potential that it's going to bottom soon because this has been a phenomenal acceleration already. And maybe the 400 level is going to hold. But is this the stuff that new secular bull markets are made of when a company that is leading in installations is dealing with inflationary problems? And I think this very clearly helps to highlight the big counter-argument for the build-out of renewable energy. The basis of a bull market is doing more with less. So when you think about technology, when you think about the great innovations that have been delivered over the last couple of decades, it's about doing more with less. Whenever a new technological innovation comes in, it's about exploiting a gap in the market by delivering something that's more efficient. The problem with relying on the wind or solar sectors is that they are more capital intense, and then they provide intermittent sources of energy. So what you're actually doing is doing less with more. And that's not a sustainable business model. And I think it is arguable that the only reason it was justifiable at all was because we were in an abundant credit, exceptionally low interest rate environment. And the fact that these sectors have seriously underperformed over the last 2 years, it really does help to put a big hole in that whole question of whether we're going to have a renewable energy revolution. Now let's think about the battery sector. I've definitely seen, I've read up quite a bit about ESS technology, and they have their iron flow battery. And the company IPO'd in 2020, or it was bought out via SPAC in 2021 would be more accurate, surged for about 6 weeks and then collapsed. Now the share is pretty much going nowhere. And the problem for these iron flow batteries is that the technology isn't really that compelling, and it's very easy to replicate. And these kinds of batteries, they don't have a lot of power. They can be recharged and expended for millions of times, and they don't really go anywhere. They weigh tons. They can provide power for anywhere from about 4 to 6 hours in terms of backup, but it's very hard to make money from them because they're in an environment where lots of companies can do basically the same thing. And then Fluence Energy has probably got a better position in that sector, and at least the share is trending higher. And it bounced rather emphatically in here this week. So this, I think, also helps to highlight that in a low interest rate environment, a lot of companies can survive because they don't really have to generate returns. But in a higher interest rate environment, you do have to demonstrate that you have a viable business model. And there just won't be as many of these companies. We'll have a couple of champions that will do well, and then the others just simply will not survive. So it is in this environment that betting on relative strength within a sector is going to be rewarded over time because the laggards are lagging for a reason. And of course, then the leaders are leading for a reason. So we're seeing that exact same kind of trend unfolding in a large part of the growth sector. When we think about the performance of the innovation type companies, the ARK Innovation ETF has been ranging now for a year. It's firming from the lower side of the range, and it could be ranging for a really quite lengthy period of time that could take years. And the IPO index is also firming from the region of the 200-day moving average in here this week. And at least it has more of a rounding characteristic that suggests that IPO'd shares over the last 18 months are starting to do better. But it would be a very brave forecast to think that we're going to have a repeat of 2020. In order for that to happen, we would have to have a massive infusion of new liquidity, and it's just not likely. So when I think about the big argument for a new commodity bull market, then I really think about it more in terms of what's going to happen in terms of Chinese demand. I'm not going to attempt to discount the possibility that governments are simply going to regulate, that there has to be more renewable energy, regardless of whether it is a good idea or not, or whether it makes financial sense or not, or whether it's intermittent or not. They might simply decide that it is in the interests of getting re-elected and help to promote it. But for supply inelasticity to meet rising demand, then what you need is for current demand to remain constant, and then a new source of demand to come in on top of it. So let's then think about what's happening in China. So they have spent a ton of money on building new properties, and there are millions of vacant properties around the country. And the cost of holding those is negligible because there's no property tax. But of course, that is also the problem. When you have a regional government that doesn't have an independent source of revenue raising, then they depend on innovative strategies to try and fund local services. So the money that they get from the central government doesn't come even close to closing the budget deficits that they have. So they end up selling land. But in order for them to sell land, they need a buyer. So property developers go to banks and they get the money from the bank. They give the money to the local government. The local government then puts the money in the bank, and you get this virtual circle. And then on top of that, you have various levels of leverage. And then when banks were less willing to lend, well, then they went to trust companies. So trusts were formed to funnel the savings of very well-connected Communist Party officials into the property sector, and they offered guaranteed returns. And right now, they're not able to provide those guaranteed returns, and an increasing number are at risk of going bust. Now, none of the trusts have yet gone bust, but it is looking increasingly likely. And then Country Garden Holdings is on the cusp of going bust, and it is the second largest property developer in China, and they have international ventures as well. So the size of the debt issue in China has got so large that the government is sidestepping the decision as to whether they should wade in and provide assistance. And until they start to provide assistance, then we're going to see additional downward pressure on the property market. And the property market is a huge proportion of the Chinese economy. Now, the banking sector has been ranging for years, and it's towards the lower side of the range. And this is pretty dire for the Chinese economy. And we're probably going to have to see a multi-trillion renminbi rescue package. And it feels like every day they're announcing a new package. So it does look like they're going to eventually get to a point where they will start to reinstill confidence. But it may take a statement like Mario Draghi did in Europe, which is as whatever it takes to get the job done. Now, the renminbi is right in the region of its lows. This is shown inversely versus the dollar, and the dollar continues to trend higher. And this is a new multi-decade high. So, as we think then about where the renminbi was in the past, there's the clear potential that it's going to have to devalue. And when they do pull the trigger in terms of providing additional assistance, well, then it's likely that some of these bond yields will start to rise. And the Chinese market has basically avoided the inflationary impetus that we've seen in the rest of the world. But if the People's Bank of China and the Chinese government are forced to print in order to offset some of the risks in the market, well, then those bond yields are going to start to rise. And they're coming off of exceptionally high levels and basically the lowest yields of any major market outside of Japan. So they have a long way to fall. And they've probably been the best performing global bond market over the course of the last 2 years. And it's looking increasingly likely that that process is over. So then let's think about how do the commodity sector form in that kind of environment. Well, if China is not going to be building as many roads or trains, and I think that the whole investment in trains is like bridges to nowhere in Japan. It's the kind of stimulus that gets people working, helps to get activity going, but it doesn't provide the kind of productive capacity that can really drive growth in future. And I think that's exactly what's happening in China right now. Now, gold prices are steadying in the region of the 200-day moving average. And something that I've seen from John McClellan is his talk about the 13 and a half month gold cycle, and that it's potentially bottoming right now. But in order for a clear trend of outperformance in gold, we need two missing components. And the first is the dollar. So The dollar index moved higher in here today in response to rising yields and the potential that inflation is going to start to bite into the Fed and that they're going to have to raise rates. And that improves the chances that the USA's interest rate differential will improve in the short term. But the dollar is overdue a secular decline. And when it eventually does roll over, and that will coincide with the next round of stimulus, when a recession is confirmed, the dollar will roll over and there will be even bigger fiscal deficits, and the Federal Reserve will provide assistance by lowering interest rates and printing money, then gold should take off and the dollar will decline, and then the trend of real rates will reverse. And the more I look at this chart and I look at how it performs relative to gold, it's not so much about the level, it's about the trend. And when the trend of real rates reverses, then that is generally when gold will really outperform. So we're not there yet. Eventually, we're going to see the positive real rate reversing, and when that happens, then we're going to see a big move higher in gold prices. And I think there is the clear potential that gold will rally in a very profound manner. Now, when the dollar eventually does roll over, I think that will also be a significant catalyst for clear outperformance in ex-US assets. So, for ex-US assets to move into a secular bull, what we're probably really thinking about is not so much about the potential that they're going to hugely outperform, but rather that it is simply that the eight large companies are going to underperform the wider market, and that there will be greater potential for ex-US markets to do better, because eventually we're going to have to see at least some process of deficit reduction in the USA, which will necessitate higher taxes, less spending, therefore less growth, and that will throw the onus onto other countries to make up for that growth. So I don't believe so much in the secular bull market hypothesis for commodities unless we start to see a massive reindustrialization process for countries that are competing with China. And a bear market in commodities would be manna from heaven for a country like India, where they need to import just about everything. And the Nifty index has been trending higher in a consistent manner for years, and it's still holding this breakout. And then the Bombay Banks index has also been firming in here, and it is now finding support in the region of the 200-day moving average. India is a country that has a large young population and is increasingly successful in attracting foreign direct investment. And I think that is something that is going to continue to act as a fundamental support for the market. And there will be occasional hiccups, and there will be occasional surprises on the political front, and that will result in pullbacks of anything from 10 to 30%. And those will be secular buying opportunities. And the mantra in this service has been that India is our favorite market for the long term, and I don't see any reason why that won't remain the case for the foreseeable future. I did say that we'll look at value versus growth as well, so that's the fourth of the big topics, and I think it really depends on where interest rates are. The way that people have been able to morph their perception and invest value funds in growth is that companies making something from nothing, building new businesses. They're creating value and therefore they're value investments. And the traditional way of looking at value is with a dividend discount model, and that it's about the predictability of cash flows. And predictability of cash flows is important in a higher interest rate environment. So, in order for value to outperform growth, what you need are interest rates. You need a dividend, you need a discount rate to compare to the dividend flow. And I don't think we're going to see value in the traditional sense of the word outperform growth until we see interest rates not just higher, but sustainably higher for the prolonged period. In other words, that this really is the end of a secular bull market in bonds, and that we will have higher rates not just now, but even after a recession, that rates will bottom higher than they did in the past, and that subsequently rates will move higher again. And I do think that we're in an environment where there will be inflationary surprises, and there is obviously upward pressure on oil prices. And if we're going to have a secular bull market in energy, then perhaps what we're going to see is that it will be different commodities than last time round. And it might not be the industrial resources, but instead we could have a big bull market in energy. We could have a big bull market in agricultural commodities. We're in a globe now where the population is at 7 billion, is going to 8 billion. Over the last 12 months, the estimate for when the global population will peak has been brought down by 20 years because of the demographic contraction in China. But nonetheless, there will still be an extra billion people born over the next decade that will need to be fed, housed, and educated. And in an environment where I guess it's really the environment is less predictable, where more people have decided they want to live on the coast, and there is a greater problem with floods or with weather, where regulations are stopping deforestation because of fears about changes in the environment. Well, then that ability farmers to supply sufficient numbers of commodities to satiate the appetites of 8 billion people. There's the possibility then that it's not going to be renewable energy where we get the big secular bull market, but rather in agricultural commodities. And we've seen rough rice prices breaking higher. I think this is much more about the El Nino phenomenon, creating droughts in Asia. So rough rice prices have popped on the upside. Cotton is in the process of completing a longer term base formation. And I think there's clear potential that cocoa prices are going to stay higher for longer, that the sugar price was a little softer yesterday, but it is now pushing up again in here today. And there's the potential here that we're going to see agricultural prices, certainly getting a tailwind from higher energy prices, but then also from weather phenomenon. Just the incredible acceleration that we've had in orange juice prices because orange groves in Florida were so badly damaged from a hurricane last year. And that's just a clear evidence of how much agricultural prices can be influenced by weather patterns and environmental factors. And this is completely independent of any discussion about the realities of climate changing and the fact that now you have champagne grapes being grown in the UK, where that was never possible in the past. And the big champagne manufacturers migrating northward. Actually, one thing that I did see today was one of the vineyards that I'm on their newsletter list. They released their offering this morning. Now, it's one of the better small batch growers in the Napa Valley. They said that they were going to leave the window open for bottles until the 8th of September. Well, they were sold out within an hour and a half of sending the email. Before I ever had a chance to click on it, it was already entirely gone. So there's still plenty of demand out there in the economy, and this is going to need to be squeezed out before inflationary pressures are really got back under control. That suggests to me that we're still in a tightening cycle. The inverted yield curve is in the second stage of its cycle. The first stage is when it becomes inverted, the second stage is when it continues to invert, and the third stage is when it stops being inverted and starts going higher again. And the time when it goes higher again, that's usually when you have the most selling pressure in the stock market. We're not there yet. It is only just beginning to bounce now. But we should be prepared for volatility in the stock market, and this is the time to be most particularly aware of the consistency of trends. Because when they do roll over, then that is the time to start taking money off the table. But most particularly, this trend of outperformance by Wall Street isn't going to really end until the mega cap companies roll over. And in order for that to happen, we're going to have to see a major economic contraction taking effect. And that, of course, is assuming that a soft landing will not be achieved. I think it's unlikely a soft landing will be achieved. But certainly, until we start to see some of these major indices pulling back through their 200-day moving averages, then the US outperformance is likely to persist. I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.